Miami.
Hello and welcome to Dynamite and Eddie. It's a retro games podcast where a couple of pals get together, talk about a couple of old games. The voice you're hearing just now is myself, Mick Clockerty. Joining me today, we have Mr. Mick McCormick.
How's it going?
And Mr. Andy Mack.
Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa for the bunker. Have you said konnichiwa for a wee while? That feels like a bit of a throwback.
Ugh, nah.
You say this every week.
It just comes out automatically now, man.
We've not done an episode for a wee while. I was like sitting going, does Andy still say konnichiwa, I wonder?
The bunker was, that was because World War
II. That was a lockdown,
aye.
But I always liked it. I remember doing the first couple and I was like, bastard, Andy's got a wee lockdown catchphrase and I've not got one. How you been getting on, lads? Anything on the gaming front or any chat in general? I don't know if we need to be strict like computer games in our opening bump, but aye, to get any news or any chat?
I was meant to get one for ages. I remember I got a hoff it a couple of years ago, but I bought the cable for it and it came last week. It's for my adapter for my Dreamcast. Gets you online, man.
But
the only games that are active are Phantasy Star Online, obviously, and Quake. I think there's a NFL game as well, NFL 2K Blitz. But I was expecting just to be able to hook this bad boy up in my CRT, man, and get right back to 1999, year 2000, go into that mad lobby and look for...
It takes you online, doesn't it take you back in time?
Aye, it's called a Dream Pie, right? It's a wee fucking pie. See a pie, but a dream what's going.
A raspberry pie, no, a steak pie.
So, not a steak pie, but a wee kind of square mobile computer thing, and it's got software in it that acts as a Dreamcast modem.
Aye.
It's an old dial-up modem. The Dreamcast came with, it was actually probably the first console that popularised it.
Now, was this full of grease and mutton, or like wires and that?
It's a nice wee clean box. It's just all software, man. It's just all software. So I didn't have a cable for it to go into my wall, but I managed to get it. And now I can go online. But I went online first, and there was no there. There was fuck all no there. I hooked it all up to a private server and that.
Uh-huh.
And there was a bulletin board saying, here's the times we all meet up and that. I was like, no! It's a hang, man. It's a group. If it's like Domino's, it's like Domino's at a Celtic on a Tuesday night. You've got to go and meet your head honcho, and they check you, make sure you're all right and that before they let you anywhere near it.
Are they going to be Yanks in that as well? Are you going to need to like get up at 3 a.m. and that to play PSO with the guys?
Aye, so there's different games on. There's like a PAL guys and then there's like USA guys. There's ones on the middle of the night. It usually takes place on like a Saturday night.
Aye.
It's usually for like 11 o'clock your time, right through to 4 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night. So, it's pretty sad to be honest, but everybody sits and gets pissed and just apparently has a laugh playing PSO. But do you know what? I had it out for, I'd say, about 20 minutes, totally lost interest in it, and then just went back to Ifinia, a private server on my computer, where it's always populated.
Do you know, we've had good crack playing that before, I remember. The three of us and Aero were on, we fought a boss and that, running about. I would have another go of that sometime, that's quite good fun.
There probably is something to be said for sitting, playing it on the Dreamcast itself and kind of getting that experience. Although, admittedly, like, not many people probably would have had that experience growing up. That was probably a fairly niche interest even at the time. So I can understand why my folk are not like just fucking play on the PC.
Yeah, that's the thing, man. It's like a pure hobby. It's like a BBS board or a fucking IRC channel or something. But all these people are like just pure hobbyists. Oh, fair play to them, man. They've kept it alive, you know what I mean? And they're selling these things. Somebody's making money selling these things, and it seems to be viable as a business.
Does it make the dial-up noise? The dial-up modem noise?
Doesn't it, man?
Oh, fuck's sake, man.
No, I need that. It's like how a cash machine, that noise. I don't know if this is just pub chat. Somebody tell me that noise they just put in, that it doesn't actually need to make that noise.
I've heard that as well.
Before your cash gets spat out, I probably need the dial-up noise or else I'll no believe that it's connecting to the internet.
All I think it does is, I think it's obviously a private server. What it does is make your Dreamcast think there's a modem in it.
Aye.
Or or maybe even simple on that, just change the Sega server to this new private server that they're on. I fancy Quake, man. I've got a Dreamcast keyboard in there that I've never used. It's still in the same packaging. You can get like 25 things for a tenner or something.
See, the wee community playing Quake, that'll be good crack. Quake was one of the classics. Oh, Quake 2, I think, was when this genre took a big leap forward, I think. People were always going about that.
That's a cracking the Quake Communist reference there you've dropped in. What I would say about that again is that that's another game that's in a browser now. It's like it's got a big community online. You wouldn't need to go looking for Dreamcast users or whatever. So you could just go on anytime.
And there's probably not many people that will say that the Dreamcast version is the superior version of Quake. It's been on a fucking million consoles. You probably want to be playing it on PC.
PC neckbeards. But that was always the case for your FPS games.
Obviously, the Dreamcast kind of handicap. It's only got one analogue stick on it, so it's not the best for FPSs, you know. Especially ones like Quake, where it kind of took it a step forward, as you said, and like you change multi-directional movement and stuff. But aye, that's me, sad as ever, picking apart my Dreamcast and shit. Aye, not a lot of changes in that regard.
Michal, any news on your front? What you been up to?
Aye, so I've been playing a wee game again on the Steam Deck called Chained Echoes. It's like a kind of retro indie pixel art RPG. Wait, no, come back.
This is the one you chandero about on a chat, innit?
Aye, you may be fooled into thinking it's kind of like a one of your throwback sort of Chrono Trigger type of games, you know, trying to like recreate that joy of playing something on the SNES, but under the hood it's like quite a bit more modern. Like the systems in it are more akin to something you'd probably see on the PS2 or something.
Aye. The phrase Earthbound inspired has turned into a fucking meme, innit?
Yeah, I know. The number of games I've got on Steam that have that as a tag, I'm now like, oh no. Like, but previously, my favourite genre of game is now just like overwhelmed with all sorts of nonsense. But this one is like, it just stands out to me because it's just really well done, really well executed. The graphics are lovely. There's all sorts of cool battle system stuff going on, progression and all that. It's got a lot of stuff going on. The story is... There's a wee bit of Suikoden in there, like a wee bit of Final Fantasy Tactics, you know, a bit of like political intrigue and stuff, mixed with a wee bit of Xenogears. You've got kind of giant mechs or giant suits of armour kind of boot.
Ring the bell for the disappearing da trope. Is it in Chained Echoes?
Nae disappearing da. It does start with, so kind of funny, it starts off with the classic scene of your mall waking you up, telling you you're late for school. But then what transpires is that he's actually having a dream, and he's been waken up by his commanding officer on his way to like do this suicide mission for a mystery group. It's a mixture of a whole lot of stuff you've probably seen before, but just kind of done very well, I think. It all kind of fits together pretty well. I'm quite enjoying
RPGs. RPGs, I kind of get enough of them, man.
your absolute favourite.
Let me pose you a question then, both of you, since right. You are JRPG heads, man, to the death. Final Fantasy 16, any experiences with it yet? Any would you like to look yet?
Oh, I'm not going to bother.
Nah.
I've heard kind of mixed things. Some people say it's the best thing since sliced bread. Some people say it's kind of so far for Final Fantasy that you can't even really call it a Final Fantasy game. I mean, I've not got a PS5. I probably would get a bash, to be honest. I'm curious. I enjoyed 7 Remake well enough. Didn't love it, but I did enjoy it. But, I mean, you're going in with the expectation that it's not really an RPG as you would have considered it. People are comparing it to things like God of War or Devil May Cry or that. And that doesn't really scream Final Fantasy to me.
Are we talking about, like, you know how you still get JRPGs? In fact, JRPGs are popping with popularity now.
Yes.
Like Persona, Yakuza, even changing their whole fighting system and bringing the turn-based stuff back.
Even the likes of Yakuza have gone, you know, you get like God of War and that, everything is putting in RPG elements, you know, crafting and weapon systems and wee level ups and stuff. But Yakuza went fucking the full way with it. Turn-based battles a lot.
That was class, that game, man.
You know, there's a contingent of people out there who are hungry for it and will still play them. I think the Square are obviously, with Final Fantasy, aiming for the broader demographic.
Aye.
Their big cinematic, you know, jewel in their crown in terms of international sales is Final Fantasy. They want to appeal to the biggest amount of people playing games that they can. But for me, you know, you lose some... I'm not taking anything away from it. I just know that it's no for me.
See, turn-based battling, right? It's something completely different for your action RPGs and fighting, actual pressing buttons and getting a response. It's like playing like a card game, essentially, and it's dead addictive and it's dead... You get really into it. I think the only thing, the only criticism I could say is a passive RPG player, let's just say, as in the old ones, there was too much of the random encounter thing. But nowadays, there's no need for that.
Artificial length, wasn't it? It was padding. It shows you a difference when you've got a really good one, like Chrono Trigger, where you didn't need to grind.
You just played
straight through. Just really well designed.
You can see your enemies that you're approaching. You can either dodge them, but you might need to do a wee bit of rogue-like to get by them or something like that. That kind of thing.
With Final Fantasy, they've always kind of wanted to take an RPG and make it like a wee bit more dynamic, a wee bit more cinematic. Like you see that with like the active turn battle system, things like that. There's been an idea that they were always at the kind of forefront of RPGs and pushing things forward, but they seem to have like pushed it so far now that it's gone beyond what you probably would have traditionally thought of as an RPG.
So when did Jump the Shark again? People say PS2, Final Fantasy 12 was probably your last bite of the old formula.
Well, do you know, they went back for 13 and people didn't like that either. So... I'm not taking anything away for anybody who likes anything. You know, you should like Kings. That's how we know that we're good people. If you like Kings. But for me, even though I enjoyed parts of 15, I didn't really like 12. I've not played 13. 10 is probably the last real one for me.
They signed off at 10, man, and just went right in, went, right, we're legends, there you go, mic drop, do you know what I mean? And just rode off into sunset, 10.
This is why I like this one, Chained Echoes, because it basically is, it's at the level of kind of complexity and progression of Final Fantasy X. It's very close to that in terms of the way you level up, and in terms of the battle system and stuff like that. It looks older, but it plays much like something around that era, which is when RPGs kind of probably peaked for me.
I'll get that on my wish list, Mick, because I'm a bit of a sphere grid head. I did enjoy some Final Fantasy X in my time. No, speaking of JRPGs, well, I played through Super Metroid because we're covering it today, and then I played through Metroid Fusion and Metroid Zero Mission. It was Metroid to do my nut, and then it was like, yous were still playing things, getting ready for the episode. So hungover last week, I started playing Final Fantasy VII again. It was after we were in Dunfermline, Andy, for a St. Pauli game. Woke up the next morning, rough as fuck, and I was like, I'm just going to fucking sit and play Final Fantasy VII. I can't be bothered using my brain. And fast forward a week later, I'm on disc 3, I'm breeding chocobos and that. Fucking addicted to it. Even though I've beat a thing probably 5 or 6 times, sucked right back in. Do you know, I was actually even annoyed at having to record tonight because I was like, these cunts are taking my time away from my real pals, Catsif and Red 13.
It's a classic, man.
So this is a game, as you said, you've played many times. You probably know it like the back of your hand, but is there anything new this time? Is there anything that you've seen that you've never really appreciated before, or anything that you, maybe as a person, are bringing to it this time that you didn't before? Mm. Or is it just a complete exercise in nostalgia for you?
There's always things. See, the more you've played it and the more familiar you are with the game, it's minutia.
Aye.
This time, there was a hoose in Rocket Toon that I didn't know you could walk into. And I was like, no fucking hell. I've never been in this hoose before. What does this guy say? And he says, oh, things have been different since the Rocket went out of commission. You're like, fucking no way, man. Look at that, eh? Things have been different since the Rocket went out of commission.
I always feel like, see after that bit where you've got a big showdown on the ship and all that, and then you end up at Rocket Toon.
Aye.
I always feel like that feels like an ending to me. I think this is like, well, I can't understand RPGs.
You've got to forge on past Rocket Toon to Aeris getting fucking stabbed, man.
Well, I know, in fact, what am I talking about then? See the bit when you're in the... when the guy summons Meteor and all that?
Aye. That's right. The end of Disc 1. That's very much... that's the Empire Strikes Back of Final Fantasy VII. The baddies win. Cloud ends up falling into a fucking magic ocean thing, ends up in a wheelchair. Eris has been stabbed. Everything's fucking bad. You've got disparate members of your party who kind of don't even really know each other, and they've kind of got to go on without knowing really what to do. And you get a couple of wee bits that are, you know, kind of like the Jabba's Palace and Return of the Jedi. And then Luke Skywalker comes back and everything's fine. But aye, we've covered Final Fantasy VII a million billion times. Just that's what's been taking up my time. And you know what? I'll be going on to it right after we finish recording.
Yes.
Good shit.
But aye, well, lads, I think that can bring us on to our games for the evening. Andy, why did you pick Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine for myself?
This is a Robotnik game. Obviously, we're big Sonic kids here, and this is a Robotnik game.
What does Robotnik go up to in his spare time?
Aye,
we've always wondered.
It's like, I've played Knuckles, I've been Knuckles, brilliant. I've been Tails, excellent. Let's have a wee bit of fucking Robotnik and see what he's all about. And the box just screams, this is going to be fucking class. So, on that note, I thought I'd get it.
Right, let me take yous away back, lads, right? In 1985, Alexei Pajitnov, a speech recognition researcher at the Computer Centre in the Soviet Academy of Sciences, created a video game based on Pentominoes, his favourite puzzle as a child. Just 9 years later, we had Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine, a Western reskin of a Japanese fallen block puzzle game called Puyo Puyo, featuring an evil scientist trying to turn a society of bean people into robots. So, this is one of the first things that struck me. And then 9 years between fucking Pajitnov coming up with Tetris and Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine coming out, fucking the world changed an awful lot. I mean, there wasn't a Soviet Union anymore, for starters. Video games took a fucking huge leap forward in between the two. This is one of the first kind of wee thoughts that crept into my mind, which was like, imagine jumping for being a Soviet scientist designing a wee game in your spare time, or better not let my fucking superiors see me doing this, to Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine. Very strange. Anyway, we've covered before fallen block puzzles, or matching puzzle games, some people like to call them. You get your Tetrises, you've got your Columnses, you've got your Dr. Marios of this world. Generally speaking, you'll have a rectangular playing field wherein puzzle pieces fall from the ceiling, and your job is to match them up based on shape or colour. Tends to be, play will end when one of your pieces breaches the top of the screen. So your original fallen block puzzle games were always a single player experience, you know, Tetris or whatever. You would be replaying it again and again to beat your old high scores, or, you know, to try and make the rocket take off or whatever. But as the genre advanced, we get more into this kind of battle format. This would involve, as well as your end screen, your opponent having their own sort of rectangle on the other side of the screen, and, you know, matching blocks falling down there as well. And you would see who could sort of last the longest. It would be like an endurance game, but also a component of them would generally be that pulling off certain moves could fuck up the other person's screen. As I've said before, I'm a fan of this format, right? I like Columns 3, I like Street Fighter 2, or sorry, Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo. I'll just call it Street Fighter 2 Puzzle, but I'll use the proper name here because I'm a grown-up. I tend to really like these Battle Tetris-style games. In terms of how does Mean Bean Machine stack up against the other ones, it's alright, is what I would say. A lot of these games are very similar, but as Vincent from Pulp Fiction would say, it's a little differences. Right? What about the little differences?
Royale cheese.
In Mean Bean Machine / Puyo Puyo's case, we're dealing with two blocks that happen down at the same time of different colours. We then have to match them up in groups of four or more in order to remove them from the board. Mean Bean places a big emphasis on pulling off kind of chain reactions, if that makes sense to you, like combo moves. You know, like if you got a row of greens out the way that would let a red piece fall down and then set off your reds and blah, blah, blah.
That's where the kind of addictiveness comes from, innit? It's like being able to pull off all them combos, like, you've took it more than you even thought you would.
Does this factor into, like, scoring as well, or, like, how well you do against the opponent if you're stacking up these combos?
The combos are good for stacking up against the opponent, so if you clear just four yellow pieces or whatever, a single stone will fall on the opponent's side. Whereas if you chain a big dirty, you know, five or six in a row, it will just rain fucking rocks down on them. They'll not be able to do anything. They'll be fucked. So the pulling off the chain combos in Mean Bean Machine / Puyo Puyo is basically how you get a quick victory, or basically how you win. I mean, I was just about to go on to actually. My main problem with single player Mean Bean Machine is that it's actually really fucking hard. I could not get past stage 4, which is Coconuts the Monkey, who you might recognise from a certain cartoon show that we're about to go on to very soon.
Oh, we're going to run it away. Robotnik chat here.
Oh, no. And if you've noticed, I blew through the gameplay stuff in 3 minutes so that we can talk shite about the adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog for Ben.
Yes.
So, I couldn't get past Coconuts the Monkey. He's stage 4. Grounder, who's another character for that, is stage 7, and then Scratch is all the way up in stage 13. You fight him just before Robotnik. But yeah, the computer AI is fucking off its nut in this. Really difficult. You're basically battering your head against a wall to make any progress. The first guy is very easy. I think if you think back, if you ever rented this or anything as a kid, you probably only remember beating the first one or two guys and not making very much progress in this at all.
Is this one of these games where it's very difficult to come back if you start losing? Like, your failures sort of compound on you, and then you can't really win?
You can pull off a miracle sometimes, but generally speaking, you know, if you're about to drop a piece in, and it's going to tie the whole thing together, set off a couple of combos, pull you out a jam, and then all of a sudden you hear, like, yippee, or whatever the wee sound effect is, that robot cunt on the other side of the screen is just chained off a big dirty mega combo. You get stones rained down on you. It's basically goodnight Vienna, man. You're not coming back for it. So that's my main bugbear with Mean Bean Machine. Just a wee bit too hard. I don't know what they could do to mitigate it without making it too easy either. But I bet it's good fun to play against a friend rather than a computer. No. Speaking of Coconuts the Monkey, The Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog. No. To cut a long story short, as I've said, this is a reskin of Puyo Puyo. So Puyo Puyo was a popular Japanese arcade puzzle game made by Compile. Sega worked alongside them to make a Mega Drive port of Puyo Puyo for Japan, which was a modest success. And they were like, right, fuck it. You know, it's no dialogue heavy. We could probably just punt this to the West without much effort. But Sega stepped in and said, nah, Western audiences don't like all this weird Japanese stuff, fish with giant muscly arms and wee anime lassies and that. What we'll do is we will reskin this and base it on this cartoon with the wee guy for Urkel, the Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog. This also served a dual function, Andy, of being a game that plugged the gap between Sonic 2 and Sonic 3.
Aye, makes sense.
Tided people over. But as I was saying to Mick before we started recording, imagine you're waiting in Sonic 3 coming out and it's like, oh, there's a new Sonic game coming out and you bought this thinking it was going to be like Sonic 2. God. You would hate this game forever.
It's just not even an option, man. You take it right back, wouldn't you? You'd be like, oh, well, what the fuck's this? Looking at the cover, you're like, yes, this is going to be amazing, man. For me, Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog when I was a wee guy was always a better cartoon. There was too much potential for weird furriness in the other one for me.
Now, Andy, being Mr. Sonic here, you want to give us a rundown of both the Sonic cartoons in the 90s?
Aye, right, your two main ones then. Could you get the one with the guy with green hair?
The first ones, the ones that were out at this time.
Right, all right. Ice.
Spinball was more based on the other one.
Right.
Sally Acorn, is that what she was called? She appears in Sonic Spinball. So that was more based on Was that Sonic Underground or something?
I think it's called Satam. I don't really... Because it's Saturday right. AM. It was like a morning, aye. Saturday morning cartoon.
You had two types of cartoons, didn't you? You had the episodic series, where, like, Adventure Time and Aladdin and all that crap, where things would happen and then something would pick up next week and then you'd be like cliffhangers. It would all lead to like a big fight at the end. But as much as the Sonic the Hedgehog was more in the vein of Rocko's Modern Life or Ren and Stimpy.
Ren and Stimpy, and I get Looney Tunes off it very much as well. Sonic is basically Bugs Bunny in the Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog, putting on wee stupid disguises and that.
Self-contained wee stories. I mean, something maybe along the lines of like a Dexter's Lab or something, and I think probably more aimed for like maybe a slightly younger audience, am I right to think, than the other one, which had a continuing storyline that went on for, you know, a whole series or whatever.
There was a lot of bizarre imagery in it, like they would turn like 2 mile roads into like ribbons for their hair and all that. They would have a chili dog in their home, and then all of a sudden the chili dog would go up and start talking. Just mental stuff. I remember one where Robotnik's Ma came to visit him, and it was just...
That's the episode that sticks out in my head as well. And that's one where, like, Sonic and Robotnik have to team up because he's like, she's worse than me,
she's
man.
She's worse than him. And she was just Robotnik with a dash.
This cartoon had a cracker Robotnik. That's another thing that goes in favour of Mean Bean Machine. Because Dr. Robotnik in this was... He was properly fucking weird looking to start with. His voice actor was really fucking hamming it up, going OTT at all times, and he was just a sort of big fucking oaf. Like, he was meant to be like a evil genius, but he was stupid as fuck. Like,
he hung about in a big gilded tower with two of his robots he made.
Well,
Grounder and Scratch. They were real badniks for the first two Sonic games, which was pretty cool.
Grounder and Scratch, we always remember and talk about fondly. But you got Coconuts the Monkey as well.
Coconuts the Monkey, there's a version of him in Sonic 3, but he's been kind of updated a wee bit.
I think they're all for Sonic 2, because I know Grounder is in Aquatic Ruin Zone and Scratch is in...
Wing Fortress.
Aye, Wing Fortress. The one before the Death Egg.
But I don't think... Hang on. Right, sorry.
Listen to us, man.
Really important that we get this in.
We can't be dying. We've got
we've
to
started,
right.
We've started now.
Is it not in fucking Green Hill Zone? Oh, no, Emerald Hill Zone.
Emerald Hill Zone, yes.
He's on
right.
A tree in Emerald Hill
okay.
Zone.
Okay, yes. So, yeah. So yeah, you had three badniks that all featured in Sonic 2. You had Grounder, Scratch, and Coconuts the Monkey. Coconuts, I think, featured in it slightly less. Grounder was like a wee... He was always kind of like, I don't know, boss. Aye, like, he had that kind of... It was like Patrick for SpongeBob.
He was like Dim at a quarter launch.
Aye, he was a fire in, as you would say, Andy.
A fire,
whereas Scratch was a bit more... He'd more badness in him.
Aye, Scratch... Like Scratch sounds like a nostalgia nerd cunt.
He sounds like Nostalgia Critic, either, but the exact same voice.
Same.
This was the TV series that kind of popularised the idea of Sonic the Hedgehog liking chili dogs, and that being his favourite food.
Aye.
And also became a bit of a meme because it did that thing that American cartoons sometimes do where it kind of teaches you a moral lesson, like a G.I. Joe or something.
Sonic says.
Aye.
Yes.
It was like a Jerry Springer thing, wasn't it, at the end?
Tails would paint... Sonic says S-E-Z, and then Sonic would come in and correct his grammar by changing it to Sonic S-A-Y apostrophe S, I believe, which is also wrong.
Aye.
It would be like Grounder and Scratch would offer Tails a pack of fags, and then Sonic would come in and say, well, little buddy, you don't want to be doing that. They make your breath gross. And then you would have Grounder and Scratch coughing their lungs up. There was also one about paedophilia that always got put out in fucking meme videos and
the strangers.
Hey kids, there's nothing more cool than getting a hug from someone you like, but if someone tries to touch you in a way that makes you feel uncomfortable, that's no good. You say no, then you get out of there. That's Sonic's advice if you encounter a beast.
I'm sure Rolf Harris done the same thing, man. I'm starting to have fucking worries here, man. it was crazy, man. And the other show was more kind of like the comics, the American comics. It was all about this wee team went to save the world and all that.
It's taken a weird kind of journey across the globe here, because you've got a game that was invented in Japan, it's come across to America and it's been reskinned to be based on a cartoon that was based on a Japanese game that moved to America.
Can I nip your brain about the lore in this game? I noticed there's cutscenes. It's probably my favourite bit. My favourite bit of the game. Robotnik's sitting with the bald ground unscratched and his big fortress.
Robotnik has gone to a place called Beanville and is kidnapping the beans in order to change them into weird bean robots. Badniks, Andy.
He's moved on for the animal kingdom onto the legumes. He's now got a new way of making robots out of another type of being.
So the lore is that you are freeing beans as you're doing this, and that each stage, you know, another one will come along and they'll be like, oh, I'm going to give you a thrashing. You know, they've all got different wee portraits and wee personalities. Some of them are more polite, some of them are more angry. Ground or scratch and coconuts act a wee bit like the day in the cartoon. You fight a different badnik each stage at this kind of puzzle game.
I like the beans. I like how they look and how they join together.
Aye, I quite like that.
Kind of meld together.
Meld, aye. And they do it in different ways. It's not like it looks the same when they do it in kind of ways that look kind of... as if they're changing every time you do it. There's nothing too same about it. Their eyes go different ways, isn't it?
The wee eyeballs on them are quite cool. Puyo Puyo, aesthetically, is pretty good. There was also... now, this is the Mega Drive reskin of Puyo Puyo. The SNES also get its own reskin of Puyo Puyo, featuring a wee pink fella we were talking about last time. There is a game called Kirby's Avalanche that if you play it, it's basically just Mean Bean Machine on a SNES.
Right enough.
But with Kirby characters. Aye, very fucking weird.
Then. So aye, it's fucking mental, man. It's like, do you still get that nowadays where the promise... I mean, it's kind of... just, I don't like it. It's one end, don't judge a book by its cover things, innit? Where you get a book with a pure epic cover in it and it's just pure written by a ghostwriter and pish.
I dare say, back in the day, if you... I'll tie this into my conclusion here, my recommendation, right, and we'll wrap it up here. I dare say, back in the day, if you'd have bought this and you were expecting, you know, high-speed Sonic the Hedgehog action, you would have been fucking gutted.
Raging, right? Man.
You would have, even a rental, you would have
off
probably...
ruined.
Aye. You would have felt like a waste of a weekend or something. However, I would recommend this one if you are a big fan of puzzle games. As I say, Columns 3 is my alley. But I couldn't confidently say Columns 3 is a superior game to Mean Bean Machine. Again, it comes down to the little differences, right? Maybe something in the graphics or the music that appeals to me more, or just, you know, whatever wee different quirks of gameplay this Fallen Block puzzle game has for that one.
The baddies in this game don't look as fucking baked as the ones in Columns 3.
Yeah, exactly. Although there's not much in that either.
See if you had even wee sections between the Puyo Puyo stages where you could just kill one of them wee sprites, one of them wee like ground or scratch sprites. It would make it infinitely better.
Like one of those fucking flash torture games where you make a hamster or something.
Just anything to do with Sonic, man. I mean, ground or scratch, alright. Beyond that, fucking who are these guys? Dragon Breath, Spike, Sir Fuzzy Logic. I must have missed them episodes. I don't know.
Apparently there is an episode where all the guys are in it in the background. McCormick, on the soundtrack front, I didn't want to get too into this. Apparently the composer of Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine was very inspired by influential electronic German band Kraftwerk.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they wanted all the tunes to sound like Kraftwerk to the degree where in an early beta build of the game, the title screen music is just the Kraftwerk song Home Computer, a 16-bit version of that, that was removed for licensing issues. Myself into the future.
imagine much better music to like join Wii Blocks together to be honest.
Right. Well, I had to get my Wii Music fact in there. Right.
Howard Drossin never get a nod for this one after his performance in Spinball, no?
No, Mean Bean Machine has far better music than Spinball as well, by the way. There you go. Check it out if you like puzzle games. If you don't, fucking swerve it. There's nothing in it for you. And the last thing I will say is that I did cheer like fuck when Sonic Mania had a Mean Bean Machine boss fight. I thought that was a cool
one. That's amazing.
Ended up getting more chat out of Mean Bean Machine than I expected to there.
It's what an enjoyable series of words to say, isn't it? Mean Bean Machine.
Mr. McCormick, why did you pick Wario Land 4 for Mr. Andy Mack?
I thought this would be an interesting Wii series to cover. Obviously, everyone knows the bold Super Mario, but I find his sort of dark and twisted counterpart Wario maybe a bit more interesting. The kind of evolution of his series from the Game Boy. Wario Land 4 is kind of considered the pinnacle of this, and it's a fun wee game with a lot of character on that. It's one that I had on the Game Boy Advance, which is a console that I always enjoy talking about. So yeah, hopefully Andy got on with it.
Aye, so like yourself, McCormick, I had a Game Boy Advance. I had the SP version. I think you had the one that you needed the light, didn't it?
I eventually get the Game Boy Advance SP, which is still one of my favourite handheld consoles, just in terms of the form factor and that. It was great. You could fit it in your pocket. Brilliant.
Well, 2001, right? By this time, the SNES period was finished. The Mega Drive period, 16-bit era was done. And you had all that repository of experience that you could transfer to this new console. That was a step up for the old Game Boy kind of graphics that are based on like an 8-bit watch. I don't know the way like a gaming watch thing was, where it's like a monochrome display. Well, the Game Boy Advance gave you a full Mega Drive and a full SNES experience. There was some brilliant platformers on it. I remember playing for the first time, Super Mario 2, the one that wasn't actually a Mario game to begin with.
That was one of the first games I had as well, which was like the remake of Mario 2.
Aye.
I played a shitload of that.
It looked brilliant, man. The colours were popping. Music was great. And it was the first time I actually had got to have a shot of that one. I never had a SNES then. So this console was kind of famous for bringing out versions of famous SNES platformers or even just reworked games from famous platformers that were on the SNES.
See, even now, right? See your GBA versions of things like Final Fantasy V and Final Fantasy VI. They're considered the definitive versions. See, like the ones they put out in Steam and that, they're usually, they made all these shitey mobile port things, right? And then there was also ports for the PlayStation 1 that was basically just an emulated SNES game, except with fucking loading screens. When they put them on the GBA, they did things like Final Fantasy V added in a load of extra job classes. Final Fantasy VI has got like an extra boss and an extra dungeon and stuff like that in it. It tends to be that the online communities, fans of the Final Fantasy series, consider the GBA remakes of these games, or not remakes, they're sort of Hoff ports, to be the best ones.
The GBA Game Boy Advance is, I mean, it's completely different architecturally wise and hardware wise, it's completely different, poles apart, but it's often considered that just a handheld SNES, I suppose. It does all the same things.
When the home consoles were mostly moved on to 3D by this point, this was your holdout for proper 2D adventures.
Aye, it's just a handheld SNES, basically. And my first kind of interaction with your man Wario, other than just seeing fleeting pictures of him on the internet and stuff, was WarioWare, which was a minigames weird to explain, a minigames game where you had to complete all these minigames that get faster and faster and faster. You had to learn them and do them faster and faster and see how fast you could do until you unlocked other stages.
Andy, you once referred to it as a toilet game.
Oh, aye, it's a great game to have a shite with, aye.
That's shite game.
It's one of the best shiting games of all time, aye, definitely. Because it's just wee bursts in it. Oh, God, that sounds terrible.
After a curry.
So that was my first sort of introduction to Wario, and I liked his wee grunts and that. Right, what fucking, let's carry on. And I liked the chaotic music as well. I had that kind of techno, mad unhinged, chaotic music. It sounds kind of like the... So I'd imagine that's what it sounds like to be...
Attention deficit disorder. All right. Same thing, innit? It's probably used to get burnt at the stake for that.
But like a chaotic techno demon.
Aye.
Something like that. So this was what I thought Wario was. I thought Wario was just this wee guy, master of games, master of ceremonies, and just gave you wee like quirky things today, and hated Mario.
Can you not remember the advert in the early to mid-90s, there was a TV advert for 6 golden coins, and Wario was in it. Super Mario Land 2, 6 golden coins, and it was like, oh, join Mario on a new Game Boy adventure. You got to stop a bad Mario.
Don't remember that.
I can't remember that, no, but I know that game you're talking about, we've mentioned this before in the podcast, was part of the what eventually became this game I'm going to talk about today, Wario 4. The first Mario game on the Game Boy was Super Mario Land. And
yes.
It had the same physics as Mario, basically the same engine and played the same, but it had the same wee bit of identity, its same universe, its same lore to a certain extent.
We've covered Mario Land on Neddy, actually. Mm-hmm. This is technically the same series as that, if you can believe it. We've just jumped over the middle two, sort of.
So the lineage of this game can be traced back to Super Mario Land, which is probably one of the most popular games for the 90s that people remember.
Aye, so you had Mario Land, then you had Mario Land 2, where the baddie was Wario, an evil Mario, rather than Bowser. And then after that, in the series, you started playing as Wario. I guess they didn't really just want to make like portable version or whatever was out on the SNES. They wanted to have somebody say an identity. You started playing as Wario. It was a bit more fucking chaotic than Mario. And one of the kind of highlights, the funniest bits about his series of games was that in order to progress, sometimes you had to get hit by enemies and hurt yourself and put yourself into like a state of disarray in order to solve puzzles and stuff like that. You might have to get set on fire, for example, and then you can burn down certain blocks or things like that.
Looney Tune physics, if something flattens you, you might need to be flattened to do this next puzzle, do you know what I mean? Turn into a wee disc.
Exactly, you've got to use a sort of, what would normally kill you in a platformer, you've got to use like an unintuitive way to progress. So Mario Land 4 was the next in the series after, was there one before this on the NES called Mario Land, was it Game Boy it was on, Mario Land 3?
This was Game Boy Color, this was one I actually had.
Game Boy Color, so this was the next one.
I think the full title of it might have been Super Mario Land 3 : Wario Land, but every current would have just called it Wario Land.
It's one of them fucking Wonder Boy situations, isn't it? But anyways, I started off this game and I'm blind and says, right, let's have some Wario, man. Kind of half expecting something similar to Mario, but boot it up. Flashing colours, it reminds me of WarioWare, man. A wee kind of intro comes on, Wario sees an article in a newspaper about treasure that's been uncovered in a golden temple in the jungle. And as a greedy wee ambitious bastard, he gets on his car, he goes there and claims the treasure for himself.
He drives a big fucking 60s muscle car.
Aye.
It just shows you how different he is to Mario, Mr. Clean Cut and that.
Aye. The levels are all split out into 6 sections, a room that this pyramid that the treasure's in. And each of these sections has 4 different levels. And the main goal of each level is to collect a key. It's like a wee flying key. It looks like in Mario 64 that follows you with a camera a wee bit. He's known as a Kaiser.
I like the look of him. He's like a wee bird, but instead of a beak, he's got a giant kind of key.
And you've also got to collect 4 pieces of a diamond for each level that will unlock the door to the levels boss for that section. So there's 6 different areas with 4 different levels in each, and each level's got a piece that you've got to put in the door to get to the boss, essentially.
In the third gen, right, Wario, I think he gets shrunk or something like that. He gets transported to a different world and then, you know, meets like a creature or a genie or something that says, here, Wario, if you collect these 8 MacGuffins for me, I'll help you get back. And then a component of that was that you could collect treasure along the way, and at the end it would show you some Wario doing something lavish with it, depending on how much treasure you'd got. Now, by the time part 4 rolls around, right, have they dispensed with oh, we have to invent something heroic for Wario today. And the plot of this is just Wario wants to get minted.
I think so. All I've got for this... Thanks very much.
I like that, Mel.
All I've got for this game is, it starts off by teaching you some moves. So Wario's got some crazy things that Mario can do. He's got an attack where he can shift his body to ram into objects, to smash rocks and things like that.
Aye, shoulder barge.
Shoulder barge, aye. I was going to talk about the level design soon, but this is kind of key. There's also a dash attack too, which is kind of like a normal attack, but he runs doing it. There's a smash attack where he jumps up and sort of lands on his ass. This has been done in loads of games. It's kind of like a wrestling move a wee bit.
Aye.
Mario gets that in Mario 64.
Aye, exactly. A ground pound, aye.
Ground pound.
And you can get a super ground pound if you got up higher, essentially, as well. You can do a wee Sonic roll. Sometimes there's wee tiny blocks you need to take out, or you need to take things out at speed. You can do a 45-degree spin to break things. You can swim, you can crawl. And one of the most interesting ones, you can actually throw things as well. Quite cool, man. So you learn all these things in the, it's like a wee introduction level, and then you go right into the full Booner. And what really got me about this is you get a kind of hub world with the pyramid in the middle, and you get different passages. You've got to complete all six passages to eventually get the treasure for the pyramid. Now, from what I read, each passage has different levels of difficulty. I didn't get that when I was playing it. I thought that the second one was a lot harder than the fourth one, for instance. I'll obviously get into it in a wee second, but you can do these at any sort of order that you want, so you're not on any linear path.
You get that Mega Man thing.
Aye, so you can do like two levels out the first passage, two levels out the second last passage, and then go back and forth and stuff.
This is quite good for a portable game as well. If you're struggling with something, you can just move on to the next thing. Kind of fits the notion of just whipping this out and having a wee shot at it.
Aye, but as far as I can see, each passage, right, you get six passages. You get Emerald Passage, Ruby Passage, Topaz Passage, Sapphire Passage, and then finally Golden Pyramid. And each of these has its own theme. So like Emerald Passage has a leafy kind of nature theme, where you get Palm Tree Paradise, wee islands, tropical fish. I think it introduces you to kind of Fat Wario and all that, which I'm going to talk about in a wee minute. You get Wildflower Fields as well, again, a nature theme. Mystic Lake, so you've got all the aquatic animals and stuff. And then Monsoon Jungle, a sort of foresty jungle level as well. And then Ruby Passage is more industrial things, like in factories and toxic landfills. And a fridge, things like that. And then, and then you've got Topaz Passage, which is interesting, man. It's games, essentially. You've got like board game themes, block themes, domino
toys
themes,
and
toys and like fun things. A bit like Micro Machines, it reminded me a wee bit. Sapphire Passage is a weird one. Arabian Nights. There's an Arabian Nights level. There's like a moon level. Fiery Cavern where your normal tropes, your lava, don't touch your lava and stuff.
Aye.
But each of these levels has its own gimmick. So, for instance, I mentioned the Fat Wario. The enemies in this game can be used to your benefit as well as your detriment. You can still take damage. You've got your bars of hearts, that if you run out of hearts, you die. However, you can also use the enemy's projectiles to damage yourself or to hurt yourself, which will give you an ability to complete part of the level.
And this is how a kind of puzzle element comes in, because there's these four gem pieces in each level. You've got to figure out how to reach each one, and you have to kind of use some of these powers to your advantage. So, like, for example, there was one level with these kind of vampire bats, and then you get bitten by a vampire bat, you turn into a bat, but that lets you fly up a bit higher on the level and get to one of these gem pieces, that sort of thing.
One of my favourite ones was you got hit with a... There's a wee guy bounces on a pogo stick, and if he hits you, you turn into a pogo stick. And what you could do is, the levels are huge in this game, and sometimes it's hard to find out where to do, because a lot of these power-ups are used to smash blocks that make you see where to go next. So, for instance, when you turn into a pogo stick, you can use that ability to bounce up through the roof in the next part of the level, where you'll find the answer to any puzzle you're trying to find. And what you're trying to do on these levels is you're trying to use these gimmicks, trying to use these other powers, along with your standard powers, like your rush and your jump and your ground pound. you're trying to use these together to find a way through the level where you'll find the pieces of diamonds that you need. You need four in each of these levels, along with the key. When you've collected those, you then jump on this blue robotic king, and this is my favourite bit, blue robotic king that gives you a countdown. Your job then is to just sprint back to the start, just scudding through everything to get back to the start, to the warp zone, to go back to the hub world again. And it all changes, the level all changes, the colours all change, the music changes into this weird, God, I don't know, how would you describe it?
The music and the sound effects in this do this thing where it gets faster and slower, like higher and lower pitch, and like goes backwards and stuff like that.
It just adds to this pure chaos. Aye.
When you're running back through the levels, because you've been exploring these levels for quite a wee while, to like find all the pieces and figure out your way about them, you kind of know them like the back of your hand by the time you got to the end, and that means when you're running through it, you fucking know exactly where you need to go, usually, to make it back to the end, and it feels pretty satisfying.
There's a lot in this game, so I'm just going to pick wee flashpoints that I found stood out to me. There was a lot of getting lost in this game, I thought. And I know that these Wario games have a lot of puzzles in them compared to Mario. Is that one of the functions it?
I don't know if I would say a huge amount more. Probably just merely an emphasis on how you think about, you know, it's not just A to B. More of an emphasis on puzzles.
The one on the Game Boy Color had that element of where you have to get hurt by the enemies to do something, but
aye.
I think this one kind of ramps up the whole idea of like exploration and finding things and kind of finding the hidden bits in the level, makes that the point.
Well, for instance, right, we said you've got to use your base abilities with the gimmick of the level, so the projectile of the body and the abilities that come with that to try and find out where to go. I found myself getting lost a lot in this game. The fridge level, when you're in a fridge, it's so claustrophobic and all the blocks look the same, and the only way to complete a level is to keep getting hot after snowing to try and chip every bit of level to find out what block it is you need to smash to get to the next bit.
There's always something in a fridge that's just been left there for too long and kind of forgotten about. So that's kind of trick.
Exactly. But I found getting lost was something that happened to me a lot in this game. Not in all the levels, but in quite a few of them. I also found that it could be a bit frustrating. Like, the run-in for the first three passages, the Emerald Passage, Ruby Passage and Topaz Passage, were quite easy, I found. You could get what you had to get for your level and sprint back. However, ones like the pinball zone, where essentially you had to play pinball, you had to pick up balls and throw them in the correct sequence of holes. I mean, it gave you 5 minutes to run back to the start of the level, but it took you 5 minutes to do that. And once you completed that one, it gave you a second one to do. So I was thinking to myself, how the fuck are you going to do this in 5 minutes? So I was pulling my hair out by the end of that level.
Andy, did you beat this shit?
I got to the final boss, who was Golden Diva, and never had a clue how to fucking beat it.
Fuck.
See, I thought this is another peek behind the scenes. You always kind of know. For instance, if Andy came on here and went, oh, by the way, I hate this game, blah, 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 I would have been like, what the fuck are you on about? Because we talk about the games as we play them on a wee group chat, and you could tell you were fucking loving this thing, man. I was like, you'll get to the end, if no fucking slightly before it, maybe.
That's the thing. I love platform games, done well. And this is getting Nintendo seal of quality on it. Wario moves brilliantly. I've got to say, man, that jump, chef's kiss, right? it's brilliant. The movement, just, you know that way, there's a magic in a 2D platformer, right? Where if you've got full control of your character, you can feel it's almost like clay in your hands, man. It's a weird kind of thing to explain. There's no clunkiness. Everything all bleeds into each other to a centre point. And Wario's just a dream to control. I love his attacks. I love his shoulder barges, the sounds he makes and all that. I love how he goes like anime style, Dragon Ball Z when he's smashing things up and all that. I love the quirkiness of him. I love his wee cheeser. You mentioned shit-eating grins earlier. I just love it, and I've got to say, Nintendo, right, they often do get slated a wee bit for being too safe and being too focused on their main IPs, but look at the love and attention that's went into something like this, you know. I think it's great, and as McCormick said before, this was a handheld game, man, in 2001, and they've done so much with it, and I've not even spoke about like the coolest point yet. when you complete your levels, you've collected all your items, you're back out into the hub world, and you've done your four levels in one section, right? So you've got to fight a boss now, right? But before you fight a boss, there's an item shop, right? It's like buying a stabber or something before you get into a boss room, right? What you find is you sometimes carry
a knife.
Something jagged.
That's some street knowledge for you there. Didn't know.
Sitting in a restaurant and going, excuse me, Hen, I've got a fork, but I've not got a stabber.
So there's an item shop, but you do find a lot of time, because you're choking the goat at levels half the time, because by the time you've finished them, you're all puzzled out. You need to go and get some money. And the way that you farm money in this is through minigames. There's free minigames. And
you're kind of gambling on them.
Right, aye. So you use your coins to play minigames, essentially, to get more money to buy special power-ups for your bosses that make them easier. And this sort of got me thinking, is this the genesis of WarioWare? Because the free minigames are very much like WarioWare, and like, you've got to jump something. There's one that's right out of WarioWare. You know that one where there's a face in the eye spin room, the moustache spin room, and the,
yes,
the nose, yes, the nose spin room. You've got to get the right one. Memory
you
game.
You have to match aye.
That's it.
I'm pretty sure this is Wario Land 4 2001, WarioWare was 2003.
I would suspect that. And also you've got the one that's in WarioWare 2 with the baseball. The ball comes in.
Aye.
You've got to hit aye the baseball away. And you've got another one where you're on a unicycle and you've got to jump. And the jumps get harder and harder. I think there's a bit in Lion King about a lot like it.
It's Wee Mr. Game & Watch that kind of runs the aye shop as well.
Aye. I thought it was Oogie Boogie. I told you I'm there.
No, he's a wee black outline because that's all you could see in the old Game & Watch. But aye, the first boss I thought I've got enough money to save up for a cannon. And then like before you fight the first boss and like this kind of boxing ring, it's like, hold on a second, Game & Watch guy pulls in, he fucking lights the fuse in this cannon and blows the fuck up the boss. And it takes rid of most of his health bar.
I like how in a shop, there's a big list of things you can buy. So you can get Apple Bomb, Pfizer Man, it's a superhero power-up. But I like how you can buy a smile for free. You know what it is? It's just a wee guy just giving you a wee smile. It's like, at least you got something, you know?
I think you get a better ending with how much money you have, usually, in Wario games. So you're possibly, if you want to get like the best ending, you're better off no buying the cannon. You know what I mean?
Right.
And try to just beat the boss
right
fucking raw.
I liked Visor Man. He's interesting. I'd quite like to find out some more about Visor Man. He's an item that can be purchased in a shop. He's a superhero. And the wee guy's smile brings Visor Man in. He's a bit like Cyclops or X-Men, where he'll pull his visor up, and a big beam will come out. Takes half the boss's life off for you, man. So you've just got to say cheers, Visor Man, and take out the rest of him. Smashing. It also exposes the weak spot in bosses as well, I think, which is pretty cool. So I always tried to get a Visor Man. It was always kind of, I think it was like the third cheapest as well. I never really partook in the large lips or the black dog.
The black dog? What, you just gave the fucking boss clinical depression? he's meant to be coming in to fight you, but he'll not get out his scratcher.
There's one that I wish I tried. And it reminded me of Everton, camping at Everton. The Bugle.
The Dead Bugler.
Aye, the Dead Bugler boy.
That's a deep cut. Are we going to have to get into this?
Well, I'll tell you something. I spread this.
Was that you?
Yes. Yes, it was. My granda Joe told me this story. We were all in the 59th scout trip.
Yeah, so we were.
I wasn't in scouts for very long. I didn't really hang about. But Cubs, more so. Cubs would have been when the 3 years would have been more into it. Although I wasn't so pally with yous, I had kind of other pals. But we were on that same one. My granda told me this story about a deed bugler, which was that, like, he probably made it up, right? I don't think that this is, like, a well-known local legend. But among us, like, it kind of is. Because it was, like, you could hear a soldier playing the bugle, like, first thing in the morning or something like that, and it was a ghost. And if you heard that, it was a dead bugler.
I definitely heard that. Usually somebody sitting in your tent with their torch under their chin telling you all about it, aye. A weird thing, I didn't remember it. But aye, the Bugle was one of the power-ups that I never got to use. I just went with Visor Man. I like Visor Man. He looked a bit like Short Fuse of Cybernetic, and I quite liked him. The bosses, the bosses, right? Fucking the bosses. So as you know, you can use these power ups against the bosses, but the bosses are these big, huge. Johnny Bransfield, you've got to buy me another bottle of Sprite, man, because these things were fucking huge, man. Good to look at
say,
as well.
Say the catchphrase.
Big Sprites.
Thank you. The listeners there were sitting, you know, you'd brought them with a point there and you were about to no say it.
Aye, big Sprites, man. You know how much I love them? Especially on usually you're just an arcade and you're getting them on this wee mini screen anyways. Right, put that to one side and out. The bosses are fucking incredible. My favourite out of them all was the second boss. The second boss is Little Shop of Horrors. Well, a cross between Little Shop of Horrors and Zippy for Rainbow. Big angry looking motherfucker, feed me. He's got saliva dripping out his mouth. It doesn't actually attack you until you smash his jar that he's sitting in, and then he gets fucking pissed off. You've got to climb up a ladder and do the drop pound on his head, man, where he goes fucking tonto, starts slavering on you with acidic slaver venom. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool, man. My second favourite was called Aerodent, right. And he's called, do you know what, I was calling him Aerodent, it's Aerodent, because it's a big fucking it's a big teddy bear, right, being controlled by a wee smelly moose. Your job is to rip open the arse piece of the bear to expose the moose that you then batter with your attacks.
Expose the moose and expose the oose inside.
I was going to say, for the benefit of any, up for our one North American listener guy, he's not talking about a big four-legged moose thing. It's as in there's a moose loose about this house.
Aye, it's a rodent, aye. And he basically comes out the wee arse flap, gasping for air, and you just fucking smash him up. It's quite cool, man. He comes out and he's like, you can tell he's pathetic and that. He's like one of them wee guys that will shout and bawl on Yahoo Messenger. And then when you see him in a tune, he'll fucking run away into Argos or something. Aye, I quite like that wee guy. That was just a great boss. Again, big sprites, and it's cool. And once you've worked out the formula, it become really enjoyable. They get very challenging as time goes on, though. Like, Catbat was the next one, and I must have smashed Catbat about 17, 18 times. And I don't think I was hitting their weak spot because I've just gendered Catbat. But I don't think I was hitting their weak spot was because she kept coming back, man. She was showing signs of damage. She was showing that, oh, you get me, you got me. But I'd always run out of time. These battles are timed, so I could never beat her. Eventually, I looked at a wee guide that told me that you had to do something with her tongue. So I managed to go on to the next bit. And the final boss was Golden Diva. Not got a fucking clue. I don't have a clue. I read the walkthrough that mentioned a wee bit about what to do with her bat she's got, but I don't fucking know, man. Any of you know how to beat that last boss?
I never got that far.
No idea
either. I would have loved to have got a treasure, but I couldn't get by her. It's like a geisha looking thing. She's got five heads. She hides her main head with a fan, and the other heads attack you full angles. But
now, Andy, know that I've ever cheated on a game or used a walkthrough or anything like that. Sometimes it might be beneficial. So I've heard, so other people have told me, that you can look on YouTube and watch somebody else fight a boss.
Oh, that right.
Give you a wee idea of how you do it.
That's a plan, man. That's a plan. There's also an Ultros in this game, in this boss. a green Ultros. She throws a green Ultros at you, it tries to bite and suck on your head.
Is there a massive fucking opera that Wario takes part in on that?
It reminded me of Dynamite Neddy boss, the final boss. Yeah, Dynamite Neddy.
Ding, ding, ding.
Okay, I couldn't figure it out, but I know it's something to do with Green Ultros, Heat Sucker. I know it's something to do with that, but I'll go back to it, man, because I really did enjoy this game. Let me just break it down then. So it's beautiful to look at, it's really playable, the levels are well designed to a point. The puzzles can be a wee bit obtuse. I like to say obtuse because sometimes you find yourself saying, I just want to go to this level now, I'm sick of it, man, I don't know what I'm doing. But apart from that, It's incredible, and Wario moves brilliantly. This is one of the top games I've played this year, and I really enjoyed the game. It was great.
Do you know, being a huskier gentleman myself, It's always good to see a thick king out there flying a flag for us, do you know what I mean?
Aye, why not?
Right, sounds like a hearty recommendation then. That brings us on to Super Metroid. Now, Mick, the reason I picked this for you, you know, I've probably picked it 2 years later than I could have. This is one that I've had earmarked for the podcast for a wee while. A good while. Super Metroid, for me, might be a perfect game, or very close to a perfect game. It's cinematic where it needs to feel cinematic without making you feel like a passenger. You never feel like you're watching Super Metroid. You're always playing Super Metroid. Your controls are very tight. Your graphics hold up to this day. The sound effects and the tunes are still fucking tremendous. It's atmospheric. It's just the complete package. And it's a science fiction game about a lone woman in deep space, which, fucking, who doesn't like that? So, yeah, I'm dying to hear how you got on with this, Shin.
Right, so Super Metroid is the sort of game that I'm dying to get on this podcast, which sits in that space where I know it's a classic, I know I'm going to love it, but just for whatever reason, there's been a slight hurdle to entry, which has meant that I've not actually given it the time to play it. So I played all the classics in that when I first got hold of emulators. There were some games that I just never, because you had access to everything and kind of instant gratification right away, some games you just play for a few minutes, get bored of, and don't put in the effort to like. So these are the sort of games that I love revisiting for the podcast.
Aye.
And yeah, I'm really glad I did. So, I mean, I don't know what more there is to be said about Super Metroid. It's widely considered one of the greatest games of all time, but give it a bit of a bash anyway. You've got this genre of games with a really terrible name. They're called Metroidvanias, at least in the West anyway. It's pointed out that they call Search Action Games in Japan, which is a slightly drier title, but probably a more accurate one. So all this is really is the kind of platformer action type game where rather than going from A to B through a level, you're going through an interconnected world and pick up items along the way that allow you to get access to different things. So early days on the NES, you had like Castlevania Simon's Quest, where you had this interconnected world and you had no idea what the fuck you were doing because it was really poorly explained. You had the original Metroid. And then later on, these games kind of expanded and got more and more RPG elements and complexity. Things like Symphony of the Night and that. But right bang in the middle, and probably the pinnacle, the perfect example of this genre, is Super Metroid. So, as I said, I've started playing this so many times, kind of lost interest. I can't count the number of times I've escaped for that exploding base. That amazing scene, but then once the adrenaline wears off and you're sitting in your spaceship with the whole world starts opening up to you, I never really got much further than it, but this time I decided to properly have a crack at it and just kind of soak up that atmosphere, and that's the thing that I really fucking appreciated, like, just starting off this game. It's the one word I want you to come away with this review for, this atmosphere. You hear those kind of iconic words at the start, like the last Metroid is in captivity, the galaxy is at peace. That's what kind of introduces you to this world.
Even every time you switch this game on, right? Which, see, for Nintendo, this is a bit fucking... See, given what we know about Nintendo and censorship and try to keep things family friendly,
aye,
I'm always a bit wondering, like, how did they get this one by them? The title screen for Super Metroid has a load of dead scientists on it.
Yeah.
It's just playing that main theme. You've got the last Metroid, the Metroid larva, and its tank making wee noises, and around it are a load of dead scientists.
Yeah, it's got a kind of horror movie introduction.
Very atmospheric.
I mean, this game is very, very indebted to Alien,
yes,
sci-fi, horror, claustrophobic, female protagonist, etc. It starts off with this, as I say, slightly horrible scene. You think that as of the end of Metroid 2, I think, the one on the Game Boy, you've captured all these little creatures called Metroids who are...
You've exterminated
killed them.
Killed
them all. you've killed them all.
The conceit of the second one is that Metroids are so dangerous that Samus has to wipe them out of existence just to get rid of them all. And then at the end, an egg hatches and there's a baby one that's non-threatening and she can't bring herself to kill this last one, so brings it to a bunch of scientists, basically.
Aye, so she's not away for dropping this off at the scientists 5 minutes where she gets a distress call, and she goes back to the base where the scientists are looking after these things, and as Mick said, they're all dead, basically. You go and see what's happening with the little Metroid, your little Metroid pal, and then Ridley, the big horrible pterodactyl thing, named after the wonderful Ridley Scott, has swoops in and fucking fights you for a bit, but he's really just trying to grab this Metroid, take it to Planet Zebes, and kind of use it to take over the galaxy with his army of space pirates. So you've got to follow him and track down the last Metroid and sort things out, but as you're leaving this base, the self-destruct sequence kind of kicks off. You have to run out the level as fast as possible. Everyone's shaking, things are blowing up. As you're kind of going up the corridor back home, it starts kind of listing from side to side in that. This is an amazing opening. It really gets you kind of adrenaline pumping, gets you ready for the next thing.
Again, it gives you that cinematic feeling, but without feeling like... But I love Metal Gear Solid, right? But a lot of the time when you talk about it being cinematic, you're sitting watching them talk about things for a long time, aye. You're always kind of in control in Super Metroid.
Aye. It's this kind of minimalist, sort of usually wordless storytelling, which we've kind of talked about a whole lot about with our favourite wee bit for Sonic and Knuckles. But yeah, this does this really well. And also at the start and also at the end, which I'll come to. But after this kind of pure burst of adrenaline, you end up on the surface of Planet Zebes, and it's a totally different atmosphere. It's very, very quiet. You get the rain lashing against this spaceship, and you're walking through these kind of eerie caves. And the thing that kind of struck me about that is that the game takes quite a long time to actually introduce any baddies or any sort of threat. It just gives you a few minutes of kind of soaking up the atmosphere and getting to know this planet. Like, the only creatures you see are like wee little insects and things that can't harm you, but are just kind of a wee bit of background detail. I thought that was really cool.
Am I right in saying, we're basically going to just Shenmue 2 this, I think, and just talk about the whole
thing. Grab yourself in.
Well, fuck it, man, it's Super Metroid. You get down and you get the Morph Ball power-up, I believe, and a computer scans you, and then when you take the lift back up, this sort of reawakens the whole system. And all of a sudden, there's a tune playing, the lights are all back on, there's space pirates, there's wee enemies everywhere, do you know what I mean? But it's this one act of, like, a random, benign, like, CCTV camera goes, scans you, and then it kicks off the whole fucking shebang.
I didn't actually clock that, but I know that you mention it. It's like making a planetary defence system has kicked back in again.
Aye.
Is that what it is? Just that one simple CCTV camera? Just
you get the morph ball and this thing scans you, and then when you go back up, there's pirates everywhere, the planet is alive again.
Oh, fuck. That's right.
So this is when things kind of kick in properly, and as I said, in these type of games, what you're doing is you're exploring a giant level. It's all kind of like action platformer. Type levels, you're shooting, you can shoot in 8 directions, you can jump, and then you gradually get more power-ups for these mysterious statues called Chozo statues. They're this kind of precursor race Samus has got some sort of connection to, and as you interact with these statues, you gain more and more powers, and those powers allow you to traverse the level. The levels in this, it's basically a masterclass in this sort of design, and it's really satisfying when it pulls it off, which it kind of constantly does, where you're walking from left to right through these particular levels, but you're always seeing little bits kind of get to, maybe a door that you need to use a special missile or weapon to open, maybe a wee passage that's just too small for you to squeeze through, maybe a ledge that's just too high to jump up on.
Or a flare that falls away for you.
Aye, you're constantly passing these things and just be like, I'm going to take a wee mental note here. And then inevitably when you get a power, like the morph ball, for example, which lets you turn into a wee ball, sneak around little tunnels, you're like, oh, I seen one of those. Like, in all the places where you remember that you could get through, come back to you. So instead of going forward on the next level, you're going to try and go back and see what I can find there.
Yeah.
And then as you do...
I can get through red doors. I wonder how you get through a green door. Oh, I've just got a new type of missile. bet you I can get through that green door.
Aye. And you're constantly rewarded for this kind of curiosity, because you can go to a wee passage that maybe doesn't actually move you towards the next boss and the next place to complete the game, but it'll get you a wee energy tank or a missile tank. And you're constantly getting these wee little upgrades that they're not even always super useful. I ended up with probably too many missiles that I knew what to do with. But
yeah,
it's constantly just like rewarding you and making you feel better, for making you feel clever for exploring.
You get in wee rooms where you can just go in and kill things to refill your tank, essentially. One of the things I got for Metroid was I kept missing power-ups. Let's see that power-up, it's got the three streams.
Spazer or whatever.
I missed that. So I got well past Craig without that. And I'm wondering how much further could I have got without that power up? Because
some of them you don't necessarily need.
Yeah.
I think I just kind of naturally got all the big ones.
You don't need to get them all then, no?
Yeah, there's only a few that you necessarily need to complete it, although it will be quite difficult if you don't have certain ones, I think.
Speedrunning for Super Metroid is a huge thing. I mean, this is one of your main SNES speedrunning games that people are still constantly breaking the world record of and shaving off, you know, half a second and just replaying it. People have found ways to do Super Metroid without the hollow, not the hollow whip. That's a term for Red Dwarf, which I've also been rewatching. The grapple beam, you know, for instance, which I am always like, how the fuck do you beat Super Metroid without the grapple beam? Yeah. It seems so intrinsic to getting certain places in the game.
That was a part where that I struggled with. I got to a bit where there was basically a big long jump with grapple hooks at the top, and it looked like
The pit of death.
It looked like I needed that. The pit of death. That was it, because there was spikes underneath it. But I looked online to see what other people were doing to mitigate it, and they were doing the wall jump, and I'll tell you what, I can't do it. The wall jump is fucking difficult to master.
I like how difficult the wall jump is, actually. See, when you look at Metroid Fusion and I think Zero Mission on a Game Boy Advance, they made the wall jump and the space jump easier to do. And I think this detracts a wee bit. I know the wall jump can be fucking frustrating. I know when you first fall into that pit, and the wee green rabbit alien things teach you how to do it, it can fucking do your nut in trying to work it out. But when you get good at it, it's like that Dark Souls ethos. When you learn it and you can pull it off from muscle memory, it makes it that much more satisfying.
I get it. It's because in Symphony of Night, they make it so easy. I think you're right. I think this game isn't meant to be easy, you know?
But also, I wouldn't call it difficult, because the game, as McCormick was just saying, you know, you had more missiles than he knew what to do with. You end up with probably more energy tanks than you need to beat the last boss. You know, if you've even been playing with a bit of curiosity, you don't need necessarily get all of them, but you end up with a lot of health and a lot of missiles and stuff by the end of the game just from playing it.
There's a lot of ways to approach this game. So as we were saying, there's some items that you need to get through the game, or you're meant to need to get through the game. Things like your ice beam allow you to freeze enemies and use them as platforms.
Yes.
You get your Varia suit, which interestingly was a mistranslation. It's maybe barrier suit.
Oh!
Because that helps you, it stops you from kind of melting when you go in like somewhere really hot, kind of lava. So you've got these items, and that's your kind of main path. You get them, then you complete the game. There's also moves that you can use, as Mick was saying, like the wall jump, and there's like that other kind of running charge jump thing you can do, and those are like strictly not necessarily for completing the game, but you can use them to get hidden items, and you can also use them to do what's called sequence breaking, which is, I'm not entirely sure if it's intended, but it's ways of kind of like skipping sections of the game by doing really high jumps or kind of getting to areas that the developer maybe didn't necessarily expect you to get to. And this is one of the reasons these games have got like this kind of this appeal that goes on and on for speedrunners and things like that, because you can like circumvent what the designer was originally planning to complete the game like much faster than anyone would expect, and people compete to get the fastest times and things like that. The sense of progression in the game is really cool, unlocking these new items, and you get that thing that you get kind of in some RPGs as well, where you're not leveling up as such, but you do go through, backtrack through old bits that used to give you a hard time, and you can breeze through them because you've got all these cool power-ups, you've got a big high jump, you've got all these cool interesting weapons, you've got a wee scanner that lets you find all the secret bits that you need to blow up to get to extra energy tanks and stuff like that.
By end game, when you've got the screw attack and the space jump and the ice beam and the phaser beam and all of this, nothing can touch you. You really feel powerful.
Aye. The progression through the game, it didn't really work in the way that I initially thought it was going to be. So you've got, like, your, I guess, your four kind of main zones. And the way I was thinking it was going to work would be, like, you go through one zone and then you fight the boss, and then you get the items that mean you can go and find your way to the next zone, go through that, etc. But it's more interlinked than that. There's more kind of back and forth. You might go through most of an offer and then get something, but then realise that you have to go back to Brinstar and get an item, and then as you're exploring there, you actually stumble across the wrecked ship, and that's this whole other thing. Like, that wasn't even on the map when you started playing it, so you didn't even realise that I was going to be there, and that's this cool wee haunted ship that was a kind of surprise as well. So, I mean, for somebody that's only playing this for the first time, it kind of kept me surprised, all the new wee areas you end up in, and somewhere where you think's really familiar, all of a sudden, if you use one of your new power-ups, it'll take you somewhere completely different.
You've got your big four, you've got four bosses, and each one of them has domain over one of these kind of areas. So you've got Brinstar has Kraid, Meridia has Dragon, the wreck ship has Phantoon, and then Norfair has Ridley. But as you're saying, Norfair is probably the third area you get to in the game, and you've explored that a good bit before you realise, I can't go any further here.
Yeah.
And I need to come back here at the end. You know, once you've got, I think it's the space jump, the gravity suit, and, you know, a load of other kind of power-ups.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool, and it's just how well-designed this game is, that you kind of, the backtracking feels interesting. Some of these games, you can get to like a save point, and that means you can teleport. You can teleport all between all the different save points and that. But this one, you can't, which initially I thought was a limitation. But you realise it wants you to do all this backtracking. It wants you to go through the same place 10 times. But then just the one time, you'll find a wee secret in it. You kind of gain mastery over these levels that were getting you gypped earlier on.
You get that Resident Evil thing as well, where you become a master at, I mean, more so in Resi, it's because, okay, my ammo's limited and I've taken out zombies on this certain path and blah, blah, blah. You become a master at taking shortcuts and, you know, working out the perfect way to get from point A to point B in the Spencer Mansion where you need to go. You get that with Super Metroid. You end up working out really quick routes from getting places.
Aye, how best to preserve your health from one place to another, and how to use those wee respawning guys Andy was talking about to beef all your health bar when you're going from one place to the next and that.
For the pipe?
Yeah, aye. And the bosses, as Mick said, four bosses, and you know, they start off, I didn't have much trouble with Kraid, but the rest of them have got a good wee challenge to them, but both in terms of your skill and your ability to, like, just shoot fuck at the out of these things with your missiles, but also they had their own quirks and their own wee bits, you know, the little gimmicks to each one that doesn't necessarily solve the boss fight for you, but might make it a lot more easy if you do figure it out.
My least favourite boss fight is probably Phantoon, the kind of ghostly apparition one on the abandoned ship. That one for me was the most generic.
Yeah, that's just like, he only exposes his weak point at a certain time or something.
Kind of run about and shoot
shielding. Aye, that's a pretty straightforward classic sort of boss design.
Kraid, you fight in the original Metroid, and if you play the old Metroid on the NES, it's quite strange because, like, Kraid and Ridley are like the same size as Samus. They're not these big giant fucking things.
Big sprite technology wasn't invented yet.
Well, you're talking big sprites. Kraid is possibly the biggest sprite that we've had in Dynamite and Eddie. It takes up two fucking full screens. Kraid is a big, big boy.
It's a big unit. Aye. I didn't find that he's kind of big and slow moving. You can avoid his projectiles easy enough. But there's something about him. There's something you've got to love him.
Cred has a factor about him, man. I like Cred.
He's stupid. Like, look, he's kind of looking at you like, come on, then. He reminds me about Ultros. We mentioned Ultros already on the episode. But it's kind of like, fuck you. I know I'm a bogging me bastard, but you know what? I don't care. I'm still big enough to smash you.
Cred has the look on his face. That sort of glaicker. It looks like a Hun that's just read in the Daily Record.
Aye.
That, by the way, Rangers are going to win the league by 40 points and that you've got no chance. Aye. That's what Cred puts me in mind. A hand resting on the belly and
aye.
That.
Can I let... Harry
Ancient
character, almost.
But I love Cred as well. If you go into Cred with, I don't know, maybe 15 to 20 super missiles, if you've found that many by that point, you really can beat them in about six hits.
As I know, like, you can, before he even gets into his second phase of his fight, you can already deal him some heavy damage with that big missile.
The super missile, just, if you've got a good few super missiles... Just blowing them into his gub, you can take out Cred pure rapid.
Aye, that tells him it shreds. You also pointed out as well the kind of melancholy of Dragon, is it? Who, if you think about it, only really fights you in self-defence.
Oh, no, this is Crocomire. He's a sub-boss.
Crocomire, his eyes are on the side of his head, which as Mick pointed out, being an owner of a rabbit means that he's a prey animal, which means that he basically is not a predator in this world, but is someone who is hunted and therefore is fighting you not because he wants to eat you, but only in self-defence, which when you think about it, it's quite sad.
Crocomile does nothing. See, if you don't shoot at it or whatever, it just stands there and goes, and makes a mad noise. It's only when you like start firing lasers at it that it starts like stamping its feet and running at you. And then that's a weird kind of war of attrition boss fight where you need to push.
Yeah, it's a tug of war sort of thing.
Yeah, you need to get it into some lava.
Mm. Aye. But the bosses, as I said, they're quite inventive. They've all got a wee something about them. All the areas of the game, I mean, you've got your, I guess, very traditional sort of themes, loosely. You know, your kind of lava zone and your water zone and stuff like that. But just bundles of atmosphere and character to them.
For those, you know, strict video game conventions, and that the water zone is the worst one.
Oh yeah, definitely. Very difficult to navigate. I struggle with that one a bit, and it's got these mad like one way waterfall things where you fall down a waterfall and then you have to make your way back up to the top, and you're not entirely sure how.
I'm a bit of a grandmaster at the old Super Metroid now, right? I can certain power ups, like when you first. Actually, Mick, you tell me. You know, when you first get the space jump and that, it takes a wee while to work out the quirks. You know, you're not just flying about everywhere, this is a pure canter, this is easy. You need to kind of learn it.
I know what you're saying about that, and it probably is very satisfying when you fully pull it off, but I didn't quite get there. That it was just a bit inconsistent for me, but I know what you mean. I'm sure when you're an expert at the game, you fucking feel like a demigod when you get that.
Even with me, the extended grapple beam section in Meridia Pit of Death is terrible. I hate that bit.
That's weird, because that didn't actually give me any bother. It was a space jump I was struggling with.
Oh, right.
Don't know if it's different emulators or just different skill sets in terms of the sort of buttons you can press.
Aye, maybe.
But yeah, there's a few small kind of things that niggles with it. Like the space jump I wasn't a big fan of. I thought that the fact that you don't restore your health at save points could be a bit of a pain, because you can get yourself in some situations where you get fuck all health and then you go out the door and there's a baddie waiting there to kill you. So you can end up in kind of some hairy situations. But these are just kind of minor things. The way we're talking about this, you can tell, I think it's a classic. I totally agree with the reputation it's got. To talk just about the music, I've got to bring up the music, but the music in this is something else that contributes a lot to the atmosphere. Some tracks are very kind of ambient, almost kind of atonal in sections. Yeah. That weird one that's just It kind of sounds like a dial-up modem.
Probably request a LAN tune for that. So
I'm going to put in Brinstar, Lore Brinstar, which I think is that a kind of lovely atmospheric wee melody. Not the jungle bit of Brinstar, which sounds like Casualty in the TV show Casualty. But I'm going to put that one in, which I thought was a kind of just shows off the sort of atmosphere you're getting for this game.
Are good at showing you what the stakes are. Mick, you put into the group chat when you'd rolled along, the game gives you an early look at Ridley's Lair.
Yes.
And you kind of get into Ridley's Lair yet. When you go and get all the power-ups and you eventually get into Ridley's Lair, the music changes and it's this fucking really sort of intense, like, you know, it's like... and it's quite fucking horrible. You get that quite a lot. Another instance of that where is at the very end where you get a power up that lets you beat the last boss, and after that it starts playing this kind of heroic music that it plays when you're next to your spaceship. And that kind of lets you know, no, you've got this. Like, you've got the fucking magic beam that's going to let you beat the game.
I won't explain the ending for anyone that's not seen it, but you go through and you fight Ridley in this kind of really solid bit of level. You think that's you. You think you're going to get your wee Metroid back. But in the next room, all there is that wee test tube, and it's smashed to two bits on the ground. So clearly Metroid is gone. It's gone elsewhere. You go through, find out what's happened. You get a touching reunion with your wee pal, which I won't kind of go into details with, but I mean, my heart was in my chest through that whole final section. It also takes like the ending of the original Metroid, kind of turns it on its head a wee bit. It's got a few allusions to the original game, but it takes it in ways that you wouldn't expect. And then you've got a final section which echoes the end of that very first section of the game, kind of race against the clock, everything's blown up, and you've got to kind of make your escape while using all these powers that you've gained throughout the entire game, all this kind of mastery that you've achieved, and just showing you that this is what you've learned, this is what you can pull off now. It's fucking brilliant.
And like Mr. McCormick, you can leave the wee animals to die.
Yeah, I was not giving a fuck about those wee animals. Just looking out for number one, making sure that Sam has escaped. Fuck your wee animals.
I always say the animals.
And then you get to the end and it's like, congratulations, you've completed the game. You have seen 50% of Super Metroid. And you're like, what the fuck, man?
Aye.
See that end bit at the end, man? That shouldn't be happening on a SNES.
What do you mean?
Just the scaling, the ship coming out and that, the the effects when the clouds all interlope with each other and stuff. That's just fucking, that's incredible for the time. It's 1993 or something.
Aye. Pull out all the stops. It's an incredible game. Like, I can't really stress this enough. If you've not played it, you definitely should. It's the reason that there's like a million different games on Steam that have the tag Metroidvania on them. They're all trying in some level to be like Super Metroid, to have the kind of atmosphere, the level design.
I mean, how many of them are better than Super Metroid?
Can I ask a question? Can I ask the age old
right.
Dynamo question, the old showstopper?
Right.
I'll ask quarterly first. Do you prefer Super Metroid or Castlevania Symphony of the Night?
I prefer Super Metroid. The atmosphere is better. You feel like you're... And I love Symphony of the Night, by the way. I feel like Symphony of the Night gives you too many options to make the game easy. You can grind, for instance. You can find very powerful weapons that let you, I don't know, just date at a canter. Super Metroid, don't get me wrong, gets quite easy by the end, because if you're exploring a lot, finding a lot of power-ups, but you still do it by your own skill. And also, Symphony of the Night, in order to tell its story, still a bit wordy, still an awful lot of cutscenes and stuff like that. At the end of Super Metroid, as Mick was saying, you know, his heart was in his throat a wee bit and stuff, and that was without a single line of dialogue. It's got that Sonic and Knuckles thing where it tells you this whole magic story just without any words.
Aye.
Or gameplay or fucking, you know, character interactions. Magic.
Subtle exposition.
McCormick, what about yourself?
I've only played a little bit of Symphony of the Night, but I'm probably leaning towards Super Metroid. It's more minimal in terms of design. It's more focused. I think it doesn't need to end. It doesn't need to. Which is what makes it great. You got a lot of games on the SNES that were called Super something, and this is definitely Super Metroid. Like, you can see that when you play the original Metroid, you can kind of tell that Super Metroid is the game that they wanted to make when they were making Metroid, but the technology wasn't quite there. It's just a very kind of refined version of it. As somebody who's kind of been working on a kind of Metroidvania type game, not really touched it for a wee while, it's given me a bit of inspiration to go back, but also a bit of trepidation, because you can never reach the heights of Super Metroid. It's going to be incredibly difficult to, but at the same time, you can kind of, it'll kind of show you why some of these games work and why some of them don't.
Aye.
Like, it's a pure teaching moment, I think, in game design that a lot of folk could take a lot of lessons for.
And Caverns of the Molten Gods by Lost Cosmonaut, I believe, is available to download in the demo. Is that right?
Just a very short demo. The first what do you call Criteria or whatever, the first area of your Super Metroid.
You know, one day people will be mining stuff like this, going, oh, do you hear I'm talking about that early alpha version of this game we love?
They'll be calling other things Cavern Likes. Cavern Venias.
But aye, Ellen Ripley beats Anime Vampires. But yeah, it sounds like a recommendation then, Mick.
Aye, 100%.
Right, well, mostly because I'm needing a pish, let's get on to our games for next time. Mr. MacArthur, I hope you've got your rapping shoes on, because it's Parappa the Rapper for the PS1.
Fucking yes, man. This is one I've been dying to play. Look forward to this one.
My wee inspirational quote on my Facebook profile has been, yeah, I know, I gotta believe, for the past like 15 years or something.
It always applies.
Yeah. Evergreen.
Okay, so I think we've had a severe lack of Captain Falcon on this podcast, so I'm going to give you McCormick F-Zero X for the Nintendo 64.
Brilliant. Well, I think there's been a severe lack of Francophobia on this podcast, so I'm going to begin Mick Little Big Adventure.
Aye. You were going to give me a fucking game designed by French perverts. You might have gone for Rayman, but we'll see how we got on with this one. Right. Well, I guess all that's left to say is up the workers.
Hardcore to the mega.
Yeah, barrel roll.
There we go. See you later.